each could have its own engineering track. For that, we'd need the advice of the scientists who would eventually comprise our brain trusts, individuals we could rely on and whom we could talk to about the Roswell debris. These were scientists who routinely worked with our prime defense contractors and could tell us whom to approach in their R&D divisions for secure and private consultations. I was hoping that the evaluation of the kinds of things we were able to learn from the EBE and his craft that I was preparing for General Trudeau would lead me toward the solution of some of the physiological problems we knew our astronauts would encounter in spaceflight. In the early 1960s, astronauts from both the United States and the USSR had made their first orbital flights and had experienced more than a few negative physical symptoms from the weightless environment during the mission. Despite our official claims that humans could travel safely in space, our doctors knew that even short periods of weightlessness were extremely disorienting to some of our astronauts, and the longer the flight, the more uncomfortable the symptoms could become. We were worried about the loss of physical strength, reduced muscle capability in the heart and diaphragm, reduction of lung capacity, and the loss of tensile strength in the bones. Yet, scattered across the desert floor outside of Roswell were creatures who seemed completely adapted to spaceflight. Just to be able to examine these entities was an enormous opportunity, but I knew we had the ability to harvest what we could observe about aliens. So again, alongside the speculations I had made about the EBEs and their craft, I listed what I thought were the major possibilities of developing product to enable us to travel in space for extended periods of time. Renewable oxygen and food supplies were obvious directions to take, and by the 1960s, NASA engineers were already designing ways to recharge the atmosphere inside a capsule and provide for food storage. We helped. It was Army R&D in our plan for developing an irradiation process for food that today provides the basis for non-refrigerated food supplies onboard spacecraft. But beyond that were real issues of health and survival. Merely getting human beings into Earth orbit or even launching them into lunar orbit and bringing them back safely were straightforward engineering projects. But the readaptation of the human body to Earth gravity after an extended period of weightlessness or reduced gravity was a far more intractable problem to solve. The physiology of the EBEs provided an important clue. Besides the development of super tenacity fibers that would protect the astronauts and the skin of the spacecraft, and the development of a food preservation process that would neutralize all the bacteria that caused spoilage, we needed to examine the ways we trained our astronauts physically so that they would be more adaptable to periods of weightlessness and spatial disorientation. At the same time, we needed to develop nutritional packages that would not place undue stress on a digestive system that needed to compensate for deprivation of gravity. Since there were no food preparation facilities on board the spacecraft, we didn't know how they stored or processed food or even what they ate, if anything at all. However, my concern over the process to preserve food for space travel was prompted by the obvious challenge posed by the spacecraft itself. If we were going to travel in space, and it was clear from what the Army found at Roswell that at least one culture had developed a technology to do so, then R&D had to find a way to feed our pilots in space. Therefore, we needed to develop a process to preserve food for space missions that didn't require refrigeration facilities and the consumption of excess amounts of energy. The problem of long-term space travel still hasn't been solved, in part because we continue to rely upon conventional means of propulsion that subject our astronauts to great periods of physical stress, especially during takeoff. We also have no magic way for astronauts to readjust to Earth gravity after a long ride in an orbiting space station like the Russian Mir or our own planned station early in the next century. Manned trips to Mars, also on the drawing boards for early in the 21st century, will also be a problem because they will last for months and subject our astronauts to a great deal of stress. I suggested to General Trudeau in my report that although this wasn't explicitly an Army R&D mission, NASA should begin the preparation of astronaut candidates from the time they're still in school. If we train our astronauts from the time they're children, the same way we do with potential athletes at sports camps, and provide the most promising candidates with flight training and military or government scholarships to ROTC colleges, we will create a cadre of officers physically adaptable and scholastically trained to enter the next generation of space travel, I wrote. I know that General Trudeau passed this recommendation along because NASA itself opened a space training camp for your future astronauts within a few years after my retirement from the service. Beyond the issues concerning the training potential of astronauts for conventionally powered spaceflight, the examination of the EBE bodies and the ship's possible propulsion system raised other intriguing questions. What if, in addition to having been bioengineered for interstellar travel, the EBEs weren't subjected to the kinds of forces human pilots would routinely face? If the EBEs utilized a wave propagation technology as an anti-gravity drive and navigation system, then they traveled inside some form of adjustable electromagnetic wave. I suggested to General Trudeau that we should study the potential physiological effects on humans of long-term exposure to the kinds of energy spillage generated by the propagation of an electromagnetic field. Biologists needed to determine how feasible such a form of space travel would be based on whether energy radiation would disrupt the cellular activity of the human body. Perhaps the external one-piece skins worn by the EBEs afforded them protection against the effects of being enclosed in a portable electromagnetic field. Although Army R&D never conducted these studies because the medical issues surrounding space travel were subsumed by NASA under contracts with the military, indirect medical research was conducted years later. Studies surrounding the physiological effects on persons living near high-voltage power transmission lines and persons using extendable antenna, handheld cellular telephones, both proved inconclusive. While some people argued that there were higher incidences of cancer among both groups, other studies argued just the opposite or found other reasons for any incidences of cancer. I believe that a definitive piece of research on the effects of low energy or ELM wave exposure still needs to be done because ultimately, even more than atomic energy or ion drives, magnetic field generation will be the system that will propel our near-planetary voyages from 2050 through to the early 22nd century. Beyond that, for humans to reach destinations beyond the solar system, technology will require a radically different form of propulsion that will enable them to reach velocities at or beyond the speed of light. Thus did my second report cover the opportunities for research presented to us by the autopsies of the EBEs and from the crash of their vehicle. To my mind, it was nothing less than a confirmation that the research into electromagnetics in the 1920s and the highly experimental saucer and crescent-shaped development of aircraft by the Allies and Axis powers would have led to an entirely new generation of airships. I know that my reports were read by the higher-ups in the military because top-secret research has continued right through to the present on a whole range of designs and propulsion systems from the stealth fighter and bomber to prototypes for a very high-altitude suborbital interceptor aircraft developed at Nellis and Edwards, now on the drawing board, which can hover in place and fly at speeds over 7,000 miles per hour. Once I finished my report on the opportunities we could possibly derive from the EBEs and the craft, I turned my attention to compiling a short list of immediate opportunities I believed achievable by the Army R&D's Foreign Technology Division from a reverse engineering of items retrieved from the crash. These were specific things, not as theoretical as questions about the physiology of the EBE or the description of its craft. But, while some might call them purely mundane, each of these artifacts, as a direct result of Army R&D's intervention, helped spawn an entire technological industry from which came new products and military weapons. Among the Roswell artifacts and the questions and issues that arose from the Roswell crash on my preliminary list that needed resolution for development scheduling or simple inquiries into our military scientific community were image intensifiers, which ultimately became night vision, fiber optics, super tenacity fibers, lasers, molecular alignment metallic alloys, integrated circuits and micro miniaturization of logic boards, HARP, high altitude research projects, Project Horizon, the moon base, portable atomic generators, ion propulsion drive, irradiated food, third brain guidance systems, EBE headbands, particle beams, Star Wars anti-missile energy weapons, electromagnetic propulsion systems, depleted uranium projectiles. For each of these items on my list, General Trudeau went into his human resources file and found the names of scientists working on government defense projects or in allied research projects at universities where I could turn for advice and some consultation. I wasn't surprised to see Wernher von Braun turn up under every rocket propulsion issue. Von Braun had gone on record in 1959 by announcing that the U.S. military had acquired new technology as a result of top-secret research in unidentified flying objects. Nor was I surprised to see John von Neumann's name next to the mention of the strange-looking silver-imprinted silicon wafers that I thought looked like elliptical-shaped crackers. "If these are what I think they might be," General Trudeau said, "printed circuitry, there's only one person we can talk to." Dr. Robert Sarbacher was an especially important contact person on our list of scientists because he had worked on the Research and Development Board during the Eisenhower administration. Not only had Sarbacher been consulted by members of Admiral Hillenkoetter's and General Vandenberg's working group on UFOs during the 1950s, he was part of the original decision General Twining made to bring all of the Roswell debris back to Wright Field for preliminary examination before farming it out to the military research community. As early as 1950, Sarbacher, commenting on the nature of the debris, said that he was sure the light and tough materials were being analyzed very carefully by government laboratories that had taken possession of the debris after the crash. Because he was already knowledgeable about the Roswell debris, Dr. Sarbacher was another obvious candidate for an Army R&D brain trust. We also listed Dr. Wilbert Smith, who, in a memo to the Controller of Telecommunications in November 1950, had urged the government of Canada to investigate the nature of alien technology the United States had retrieved from crashed extraterrestrial vehicles, and that was at that time being studied by Vannevar Bush. Dr. Smith, who had learned of the U.S. investigation from Sarbacher, said that regardless whether UFOs fit into our belief system or not, the fact was we had acquired them, and it was important for us to harvest the technology they contained. He implored the government to make a substantial effort to utilize alien technology. General Trudeau joked that though Dr. Smith knew that we had acquired technology at Roswell, he didn't really know what it was. "I can't wait to see his face when you open your briefcase in front of him, Phil," the general said, thinking about how his old friend had always wanted to know the specifics of what he had secreted away in 1947. Each of these scientists had maintained existing relationships with any number of defense contractors during the 1950s. General Trudeau also had relationships with Army contractors who were developing new weapon systems for the military within one part of the company, while another part were harvesting some of the same technology for consumer products development. These were companies: Bell Labs, IBM, Monsanto, Dow, General Electric, and Hughes that General Trudeau wanted to talk to about the list of technological products that we'd compiled from our R&D Roswell nut file. "You begin calling your scientist friends," General Trudeau announced, "and make whatever appointments you want." "Where are you going to be, General?" I asked. "I'm going to be taking some trips too," he said. "First to the chief of staff to make sure we have the discretionary budget we're going to need. Then to some of the people I want you to talk to once you have the backing from the scientific community for the projects on your list." "Where to first?" I asked. "What do you like?" the general shot right back at me. "We've been working with image intensifiers for some time," I said. "We even got our hands on devices the Germans were working on at the end of the war." "Well then, why don't you make a very preliminary trip over to Fort Belvoir?" General Trudeau said. "They've had a night vision project in the works for the past 10 years, but it's got nothing over what you have in your file." "I'll get over there first thing," I said. "Yes, Phil, but you get out of that uniform and into a real lawyer suit," the general ordered, "and don't take your staff car." He saw me raise my eyebrows. "All you're going to do is feed a project," Trudeau continued, "that's been underway since right after the war. They've got stuff, but you're going to give them a giant leap. Once you've fed them, you'll disappear, and I'll assign a night vision project manager here to see the development through." I prepared to leave his office. "No one will know, Phil," he said. "Just like you thought, the Roswell night viewer will put a seed of an idea in someone's mind over at Fort Belvoir, and it will become part of a long-term project history. It will disappear, just like you, into the history of the product development." "Yes, sir," I said. I was beginning to realize just how lonely this job could be. "You still have a suit that fits?" the general asked. "I think so," I answered. "Maybe what I wore over at the White House is still a little out of style, but it'll pass." "Good luck, Phil," General Trudeau said. "Make sure no one knows where you're going, and I'll make sure you have all the budget you need." This was the beginning. I saluted, but the general just stuck out his hand and I shook it. We both realized in that moment, as we were striking out on our own, just how momentous this was about to become. A lieutenant general allocating money for his development budget, and a lieutenant colonel looking for someone to develop an innocuous-looking eye shield an unknown GI had picked up out of the sand near a UFO crashed into a rock in the lonely desert outside of Roswell in a lightning storm 14 years ago. What a pair we must have made. Chapter 9. Hostile Intentions and the Other Cold War. The project had officially begun. General Trudeau marched down the hall to his boss at the Pentagon to begin the process of funding the new items we'd identified in our foreign technology budget. And I went home that evening and tried on my official White House 3-piece suit. President Eisenhower once told me that he always trusted a man who wore a vest, and I never forgot it. Although there were times when the president asked me to wear my uniform for special meetings when I had to look military, I usually wore suits every day to work. But after my years at the Red Canyon missile base and in combat uniform in Germany, I lost the knack of wearing civilian clothes. Nevertheless, Here I was again after all those years wearing my suit just like any other 9-to-5 commutant Joe as I headed toward Fort Belvoir, perhaps the Army's most important base in the entire Washington Military District. Fort Belvoir was one of those military posts where the mundane activity of training and weapons testing was an effective cover for what came to be known as the secret life of Fort Belvoir. It sat comfortably within 30 minutes of the Pentagon, and where some of the Army's most top-secret research into UFO technology was also taking place. Belvoir housed the Army Engineering School, and, for former artillery and missile officers like myself, maintained a vital information database about ballistics testing and the development of new weapons. But on the secret side of the ledger, Fort Belvoir was home to the Signals School, where officers for the National Security Council who had top-secret crypto clearance were trained. Even years after I retired from active duty, stories lingered about the records of UFOs that were stored at Fort Belvoir, including photos and even motion pictures of military retrievals of downed extraterrestrial craft. What very few people knew was that an elite secret Air Force unit operated out of Fort Belvoir, ostensibly an Army base, that was responsible for retrievals of downed UFOs. That was how Fort Belvoir came to be the repository of classified UFO footage. Those secrets remained at Fort Belvoir over the years and were closely guarded while the installation remained shrouded in mystery. For those who suspect what information was kept at the base, Fort Belvoir remains a central part of the legend surrounding the official military cover-up of UFOs. Me? I was on my way there to talk about the Night Vision Project to see what German World War II files they were keeping on the infrared viewfinders the Nazis were trying to deploy for their night-fighting troops. These were cumbersome, unwieldy devices that left infantry hampered and weighed down. They were never effective in the war, but held out the enormous promise of opening up the night as a battlefield where the Army could maneuver around its blind and helpless enemy. That was the promise that tantalized both the Soviet and American forces as we closed in on Germany's most secret weapons facilities during the final months of the war. Our forces secured all of the German records on mountable weapon night viewers and headpieces. But it wasn't until we looked inside the crashed Roswell vehicle and saw a hazy daylight through the viewports that we realized just what the potential of night viewing could be. We understood in those few moments after the vehicle was brought back to Wright Field and General Twining made his initial report that we were the blind and helpless enemy through the eyes of the EBEs. These creatures controlled our night skies, observing us with an ease that we didn't enjoy until we had deployed our own night-viewing goggles years later and leveled the playing field against them and the Soviet client forces arrayed against us. My very proper-looking deep-blue Oldsmobile might not have been a secret weapon in America's arsenal, but it was carrying a description of one of the tiny components of what would be our most effective Cold War weapons. Guerrilla armies used the night itself on their familiar home territory as a tactical weapon that allowed them to move right past enemy positions without being spotted. They could secure a battlefield advantage as if they were invisible. But equip a patrol with night viewers, mount the night viewers on tanks and observation vehicles, hover over a battlefield at night in helicopter gunships equipped for night vision, and suddenly, the night becomes day, and the invisible enemy appears in your gun sights like prey for the hunter. To the EBEs, we were the prey, and we knew they were monitoring our defenses, surveilling the aircraft we scrambled to chase them, and hovering above the experimental satellites we'd launched. We could see them with our radar. I had seen them on our scopes with my own eyes, and we knew their presence wasn't benign. But they had an advantage over us that we couldn't overcome unless we acquired the technological ability to put up enough of a defense to make their costs too high to engage in any large-scale warfare. Not only was it an advantage that forced us to scrape whatever technology we could off the edge of our encounters with them, it was one of the many factors that forced us into a silence about the alien presence. If there was no public enemy, there would be no pressure from the public to do anything about it. So we simply denied all extraterrestrial activity because no aliens meant no military responsibility to counter their threat. But all the while, we were still planning, measuring their hostile intentions, and pushing through weapons development that might reduce their advantage. It would have been next to impossible to stage a military buildup that would help us fight extraterrestrial enemies had we not had a lot of help from our old adversaries, the Soviets and the Chinese. The Soviets made no bones about their intentions to dominate the world through communist revolutionary coups and set about immediately to challenge us even before World War II ended. By 1948, the Iron Curtain had dropped over Eastern Europe, and the Soviets were trying to back us into a position of appeasement. In 1949, Mao Tse-tung drove Chiang Kai-shek out of mainland China to the island of Taiwan, and the United States had another major communist adversary trying to impose its will upon its Asian neighbors. We first tasted their blood in Korea, and would soon almost choke on it in Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, and Cambodia. Those were hard times, made even harder because the U.S. military also knew that not just the free world, but the whole world was under a military threat from a power far greater than the combined forces of the Soviet Union and the Republic of China. We didn't know what the EBEs wanted at first, but we knew that between the cattle mutilations, surveillance of our secret weapons installations, reports of strange abductions of human beings, and their consistent buzzing of our unmanned and manned space launches, the EBEs weren't just friendly visitors looking for a polite way to say, "Hello, we mean you no harm." They meant us harm, and we knew it. The problem was we couldn't do anything about it at first, and anything we did try to do had to be done in complete secrecy, or it would set off a worldwide panic, we believed. This was where the Cold War turned out to be a tremendous opportunity for us, because it allowed us to upgrade our military preparedness in public to fight the communists while secretly creating an arsenal and strategy to defend ourselves against the extraterrestrials. In short, the Cold War, while real enough and dangerous enough, was also a cover for us to develop a planetary tracking and defense system that looked into space as well as into the Soviets' backyard. And the Soviets were doing the exact same thing we were, looking up at the same time they were looking down. In an only tacitly acknowledged cooperative endeavor, the Soviets and the Americans, while each one was explicitly using the Cold War to gain an advantage over the other, both sought to develop a military capability to defend ourselves against extraterrestrials. There were very subtle indications of this policy in the types of weapons both countries developed, as well as in our behavior toward one another every time one side came close to pushing the button. I can tell you definitively because I was there when we avoided nuclear war, because both military commands were able to pull back when they stared over the cliff into the flaming volcano of war that threatened to engulf all of us at least four times between 1945 and 1975. The Berlin airlift, the Chinese invasion of Korea, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Yom Kippur War, and probably many more. By the time President Nixon returned from China, having agreed to turn over Vietnam to the communists, he had effectively turned the Soviets' flank in the Cold War. For the next decade, the Soviets felt caught between the Chinese, with whom they'd fought border wars in the past, and the United States. When President Ronald Reagan demonstrated to Mikhail Gorbachev that the United States was capable of deploying an effective anti-missile defense and sought Soviet cooperation in turning it against the extraterrestrials, all pretext of the Cold War ended, and the great Soviet monolith in Eastern Europe began to crumble. But the Cold War worked its magic for both superpowers by allowing them to prepare defenses against the extraterrestrials without ever having to disclose to the public what they were really doing. When you examine it, the record itself should have showed that another agenda was present throughout the Cold War. After all, why did each side really have 10 or more times the number of warheads needed to completely destroy the other side's nuclear missile arsenal as well as their major population centers? The real story behind the vast missile arsenals, the huge fleets of bombers, and the ICBM submarine platforms that both sides deployed was the threat to the aliens that if they occupied a portion of our planet, we had the firepower to obliterate them. If they attacked either the United States or the Soviet Union so as to render one of the arsenals inoperable, we had enough missiles to spare to make them pay so heavy a price for starting a war it wasn't even worth trying. That was part of our secret agenda behind the huge military buildups of the 1950s and 1960s. Sacrifice a portion of the planet so the rest of us could live. It enabled the United States and the USSR to intimidate one another, but it also worked for the heads of the military intelligence agencies as a way to intimidate any extraterrestrial cultures. Nobody wrote any memos about this because weapons deployment during the Cold War was the cover for the secret agenda against the extraterrestrials. Sure, there was gamesmanship going on during those 40 years from 1948 through 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. Each side wanted to get the other to spend more money than they really had so as to weaken their economy. Our CIA consistently gave us false estimates because they were feeding us KGB information while, I know, we tried to do the same thing to the Soviets. And if the Soviets could have won the Cold War as bloodlessly as possible, they would have done so. But in the end, as the futility of mutual destruction made World War III unfightable, our real attention became more focused on the common enemy, the extraterrestrials who refused to go away. There were subtle and not so subtle hints during the entire Cold War that a hidden agenda was in play. Most people just didn't know where to look. For those who did, and there were and are plenty of them, the answers were in plain view. Although there was a heavy censorship and the threat of ruined careers, plenty of military and civilian sources reported flying saucer sightings. Stories of abductions, while most were either fantasies, nightmares, or memory screens for other events in the so-called abductee's childhood, continued to abound. Some were true. And this caused great consternation among members of the UFO working group. If the government couldn't protect private citizens from abductions by extraterrestrials, then would that not signify a breakdown in governmental authority? That was the worry, but it didn't come to pass. Similarly, if too many flying saucers were seen by too many people at the same time, wouldn't it become obvious that the military forces of the superpowers couldn't protect their populations? For a time it was true, but the public never realized it. Soon we were able to upgrade our ability to defend our airspace so that we could amass large numbers of interceptors against the EBE's limited resources and pose a real threat to them. They backed off and probed our defenses only when it seemed safe. Thus, the race among the superpowers to spend billions of dollars to build the fastest and best interceptors had a true double purpose. We needed all these planes because they gave the superpowers a flexible response alternative to simply obliterating themselves with guided missiles. But at the same time, both superpowers were developing the air defense technology to defend the planet against the extraterrestrials. Everybody wants the best and fastest plane, of course, so that we can outfly and outshoot the enemy we know about. But we were also defending our skies against an enemy we didn't admit to having. The second agenda was always there, and the Cold War provided the budgetary impetus the military needed. We were building aircraft to protect against flying saucers. And in a very real measure, we succeeded. Both the United States and the USSR were sensitive to another area where extraterrestrials were aggressing upon our military personnel, our respective space exploration programs. From the very beginning of our endeavors to put satellites in orbit, the extraterrestrials have been surveilling and then actively interfering with our launch vehicles, and in some cases, demand and unmanned payloads themselves by buzzing them, jamming radio transmissions, causing electrical problems with the spacecraft systems, or causing mechanical malfunctions. American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts have separately reported sightings of UFOs so routinely that it's become commonplace. The audio-video transmission downlink between space capsules and NASA, however, is a secure scrambled signal, so that commentary about UFOs shadowing the spacecraft can't be picked up by private listeners. Even then, the astronauts are specifically instructed not to report UFO sightings until they are debriefed once they've landed. Astronaut Gordon Cooper, for example, reported that when he was a fighter pilot over Germany in the 1950s, he scrambled with other Sabre jet fighter pilots to intercept a formation of UFOs flying over his base. But when his fighter group got too close, the formation of UFOs flew away. Cooper also described film that he saw at Edwards Air Force Base in California in 1957 of a UFO landing. He said that he sent the film to Washington and followed up on it with the officers at Project Blue Book, but they never responded to his queries. Similarly, X-15 pilot Joe Walker revealed that his 1961 mission in setting a new world airspeed record was also to hunt for UFOs during his high-altitude flights. He also said that he filmed UFOs during an X-15 flight a year later in 1962. Other reports persisted about Mercury 7 astronauts being shattered by UFOs, and about Neil Armstrong's having seen an alien base on the moon during the Apollo 11 flyover and landing. NASA has, of course, not admitted to any of this, and very correctly, it's been treated as a matter of high national security. An extraterrestrial presence on the moon, whether it was true or not in the 1950s, was an issue of such military importance that it was about to become a subject for National Security Council debate before Admiral Hillenkoetter and Generals Twining and Vandenberg pulled it back under their working group security classification. The issue never formally reached the National Security Council, although Army R&D under the command of General Trudeau in 1958 quickly developed preliminary plans for Horizon, a moon-based construction project designed to provide the United States with a military observation presence on the lunar surface. Started in the late 1950s and set for completion between 1965 and 1967, Horizon was supposed to establish defensive fortifications on the moon against the Soviet attempt to use it as a military base, an early warning surveillance system against the Soviet missile attack, and, most importantly, a surveillance and defense against UFOs. It was, to be blunt, a plan to establish a skirmish line in space to protect the Earth against the surprise attack. But Horizon was sidetracked when the National Space and Aeronautics Act gave control over space exploration to the civilian NASA, effectively eliminating the military branches from pursuing their own projects until much later in the 1970s. Fears of an attack to probe our planet's ability to defend itself were running rampant at national security and through the military chiefs of staff during the middle 1950s. After he retired from the Army, even General Douglas MacArthur got into the fray, urging the military to prepare itself for what he felt would be the next major war. He told the New York Times in 1955 that the nations of the world will have to unite for the next war will be an interplanetary war. The nations of the Earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. The public took little notice of that comment, but it was, in fact, a disclosure of the strategic thinking of the military back in the 1950s and explains part of the paranoia the government was displaying about all the information relating to flying saucers and unidentified aircraft. Part of the military response to what they perceived as threats from extraterrestrials was, first, to analyze the specific ways that alien spacecraft passively disrupt our defenses and worldwide communications through electrical and magnetic field interference and develop circuitry hardened against it. Second, General Trudeau and his counterparts in the other branches of the military at the Pentagon, charged with strategic planning, looked at the aggressive behaviors of the EVEs. They didn't just shadow or surveil our spacecraft in orbit. They buzzed us and tried to create such havoc with our communication systems that NASA more than once had to rethink astronaut safety in the Mercury and Gemini programs. Years later, there was even some speculation among Army intelligence analysts who had been out of the NASA strategy loop that the Apollo moon landing program was ultimately abandoned because there was no way to protect the astronauts from possible alien threats. The alien spacecraft were also aggressively buzzing our frontline defenses in Eastern Europe, either looking for blind spots or weaknesses, or, which is what I believe because I was there and saw it with my own eyes, probing our radar to see how quickly we responded. We'd see blips shoot across our screens that we couldn't identify, and suddenly they'd disappear. Then they'd reappear, only this time even closer to our airfields or missile launchers. Once we determined that we weren't being probed by Soviet or East German aircraft, we sometimes decided not to respond to the threats. Many times they'd just go away. But other times they would play cat and mouse, edging ever closer until we had to respond. That's what they were looking for, how quickly we could respond and pick them up on our targeting radars or catch up to them with our interceptors. Whenever we'd get just about there for an aerial sighting, they take off out of our atmosphere at speeds over 7,500 miles an hour. If we tried to follow, they'd play us along until our flyers had to return. Our successes in defending against them back in the late 1950s and early 1960s occurred when we were able to get a firm tracking radar lock. Then, when we locked our targeting radars on, the signals that missiles were supposed to follow to the target, it somehow interfered with their navigation ability, and the vehicle's flight became erratic. If we were especially fortunate and able to boost the signal before they broke away, we could actually bring them down. Sometimes we actually got lucky enough to score a hit with a missile before the UFO could take any evasive action, which an Army Air Defense Battalion did with an anti-aircraft missile near Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany in May 1974. The spacecraft managed to crash land in a valley. The craft was retrieved and flown back to Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. The Roswell crash was different. There was much speculation that it was a combination of the desert lightning storm and our persistent tracking radars at Alamogordo and the 509th that helped bring down the alien vehicle over the New Mexico desert in 1947. Then there were the suspected cattle mutilations and the reported abductions, perhaps the most direct form of intervention in our culture short of direct attack upon our installations. While debates broke out among the debunkers, who said these were a combination of hoaxes, attacks by everyday predators on cattle, psychological flashback memories of episodes of childhood abuse in cases of reported abductees, and out-and-out fabrications of the media, field investigators found they could not explain away some of the cattle mutilations, especially where laser surgery seemed to be used, and psychologists found alarming similarities in the descriptions of abductees who had no knowledge of one another's stories. The military intelligence community regarded these stories of mutilations and abductions very seriously. They worked up descriptions of at least three separate scenarios in which, one, the EBEs were simply conducting scientific experiments on earthly life forms and collecting whatever specimens they could without causing too much disruption and alerting us. Two, the EBEs were actively collecting specimens and conducting experiments so as to determine whether this was a hospitable environment for them to inhabit, and any disruption they caused was of no concern to them. And three, all of the experimentation and specimen collection were the prelude to some kind of infiltration or invasion of our planet. We did not know their motives, but could only assume the worst, and therefore needed to defend ourselves however we could. While never disclosing it publicly, military intelligence analysts supported the view that Earth was already under some form of probing attack by one or more alien cultures who were testing both our ability and resolve to defend ourselves. Without ever directly addressing whether contacts between the aliens and Earth governments had already taken place, because the notes and minutes of the Hill and Cotter Working Group were never released to the chiefs of staff or to their intelligence officers, the heads of the armed services decided collectively that it was better to plan for a war rather than be surprised. At the same time, the civilian leaders of the nation's space program at NASA decided that military intelligence was overreacting to the shadowing and buzzing of our spacecraft. NASA, which had been holding as highly confidential any reports of extraterrestrial activity surrounding our space vehicles, nevertheless decided to adopt an internal official wait-and-watch attitude because they believed that it would have been impossible to launch an explicitly military defensive space program and still achieve the civilian and scientific aims at the same time. So NASA agreed to go covert. As a cover, NASA in 1961 agreed to cooperate with military planners to work out a second-tier space program within and covered up by the civilian scientific missions. They agreed to open up a confidential back-channel communications link to military intelligence regarding any hostile activities conducted by the EBEs against our spacecraft, even if these included only shadowing or surveillance. I was aware of this through my contacts in the military intelligence community. What NASA didn't tell military intelligence, of course, was that they already had an even more classified back channel to the Hill and Cotter Working Group and were keeping them updated on every single alien spacecraft appearance the astronauts reported, especially during the early series of Apollo flights when the EBE craft began buzzing the lunar modules on successive missions after they thrusted out of Earth orbit. Even though military intelligence was kept out of the operational loop between NASA and the working group, I and a few others still had contacts in the civilian intelligence community that kept us informed. And the Army and Air Force managed to find at least 122 photos taken by our astronauts on the moon that showed some evidence of an alien presence. It was startling to find and was one of the many reasons that the Reagan administration pushed so hard for the Space Defense Initiative in 1981. In 1960, upon the confidential approval of the working group and at the request of the National Security Agency, which was concerned about the vulnerability of its U-2 flights, NASA agreed to allow some of its missions to become covers for military surveillance satellites. These satellites, although approved for surveillance of Soviet ICBM activity, were also supposed to spot alien activity in remote portions of the Earth. Maybe in the 1960s we didn't have the technology we have now to intercept their ships, but by using new satellite surveillance techniques, we believed we'd be able to pick up the signatures of an alien presence on the face of our planet. If we made it too difficult for them to set up shop with bases on Earth, military intelligence planners speculated, maybe they would simply go away. This was another example of how Cold War strategy was utilized for the dual purpose of trying to surveil extraterrestrial activity under the cover of surveilling Soviet activity. However, through the 1960s, Critical projects were started at the Foreign Technology Desk to protect vital command and control systems, including the hardening of communications and defense computer circuitry by burying components sensitive to electromagnetic pulses, the same kind of energy generated after a nuclear explosion as well by the EBE spacecraft. In fact, so important was our research into the effects of the electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, that ever since the late 1950s, the Department of Defense has been simulating EMPs to determine how to protect the circuitry in its planes, tanks, missiles, and ships from being disabled by it. EMP generators were established at a number of facilities around the country, including the Harry Diamond Laboratories in Adelphia, Maryland for the Army and the EMP Empress 1 and 2 simulators for the Navy in the middle of Chesapeake Bay, and another one at China Lake in California. The Air Force set up EMP simulators at Kirkland Air Force Base in New Mexico and the Army additional facilities at White Sands, New Mexico, and at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama. We also initiated the crash development of night vision equipment to enable our troops to see at night the same way the EBEs did, finally enabling us to get a footing, if not an equal footing, with the aliens, so that we could force them to some kind of a stalemate. It was only then that we began to realize what their intentions were and the startling secrets about their existence on this planet. It was night vision that was on my mind today as I was zipped through the sentry post at the main gate and very quickly buzzed into the Development Laboratories wing at Fort Belvoir by an Army Specialist 4, who seemed surprised that I wasn't in uniform. Colonel Corso, Dr. Paul Fredericks, technology development consultant to the night vision section at Fort Belvoir, said as he extended his hand and walked me over to what must have been his prized tobacco-colored leather chair. It was way oversized for his small office and was obviously his favorite seat. I was duly appreciative of the honor and courtesy he was according me. General Trudeau told me you were bringing us some remarkable information about one of the projects we have in development here. I hope it's helpful to you, Dr. Fredericks, I began. I'm not a physicist, but I think we have something that might speed up the research timeline and show some new possibilities. Anything that could help, Colonel, he said, as I opened up my briefcase and began to spread out what I had. Anything at all. Chapter 10, The U-2 Program and Project Corona. Spies in Space. Of course, General Trudeau has been in touch with Don and the whole development team here, Dr. Fredericks continued as he watched me open the night vision file that I'd taken out of my briefcase. And I'm aware of the nature of the material you've got. It's not something we wanted to talk about over the phone. I appreciate your being discreet about this, Dr. Fredericks, I said. If you think what I'm about to show you can help you in the development process, it's yours to use. But the arrangement will be that everything is originated here at Fort Belvoir. All R&D will do will be to provide the budget necessary to fund this development. You use your own sources to manufacture the product and take all the credit for the process. And this conversation? Dr. Fredericks asked. Once you tell me you can use what I've brought and we get you the budget you require, I began, this conversation never took place, and you will take my name off your appointment schedule. Now you really do have my interest, he said, with just the edge of a bemused sarcasm in his voice, as if he'd been down this road many times before. What did you bring in that briefcase that's so secret? And with that, I held up the first of the Army's 1947 sketches of the night viewer we pulled from the wreckage at Roswell. I handed it across to Dr. Fredericks, who looked at it and turned it around with his fingertips as if he were holding one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You don't have to be so careful with it, Dr. Fredericks, I said. I've made a few thermal copies. Do you have the actual device? He asked. Back at the Pentagon. Who's wearing this? He said. At the time, nobody, I told him. According to the field report, they found this in the sand near one of the bodies.
Bodies?
At the Roswell crash? Now he was completely incredulous. General Trudeau didn't tell anyone about bodies. No, that's true, I said. That's not information we give out. General Trudeau authorized me to answer any questions you have up to a certain level of security classification. We're not there yet, Dr. Fredericks asked and asserted at the same time. But we're close, I suggested. I can talk about the device, talk about where it was found, but that's probably as far as I can go myself. If General Trudeau wants to give a background briefing and authorizes me to do so, then I can go deeper. Funny, but I always thought Roswell was a kind of legend. You know, they found something, but maybe it was Russian, Dr. Frederick said. Then he asked again if anyone at the Roswell retrieval had actually seen any of the creatures wearing the night vision device and the sketches. No, I said. There was a lot of debris that spilled out of the craft. The soldiers on the retrieval team looked through one of the seams that had been split open running along the craft's lengthwise axis, and they saw viewports built into the hull. Well, what astonished them was that when they looked through the viewports, they could see daylight, or a greenish, hazy kind of diffused light that looked like dusk, but outside it was completely dark. Paul Fredericks was on the edge of his seat now. No one at the crash site knew anything about night viewers the Germans were developing during the war, I explained, so even the officers on the retrieval team were amazed at what they were seeing. When they autopsied the alien at the 509th and pulled off these eyepieces, is the only word I can use for them, they realized they were a complicated set of reflectors that gathered all the available light and turned them into nighttime image intensifiers. I continued, pointing to the sketch in Paul Frederick's hand. Some medical officer tried to look through it down a dark hall, and it made the images stand out, but nothing was ever done with it, and they packed it away with the rest of the alien. Did they perform any analysis on this when they brought it back? Fredericks asked. Some, I told him, but they had no facilities at the 509th and had to wait until they brought it back to Wright. It wasn't until the intelligence boys at the Air Materiel Command got hold of it that they realized that this was something the Germans were trying to deploy. But this is far more sophisticated, Dr. Fredericks said. The Germans weren't even close to something like this. Yes, sir, I said, not even close. And that's what got the intelligence people at Wright so concerned. Just how close were the Germans to get this when the war ended? What else had they gotten their hands on? Did they have help? Or, Dr. Frederick said very slowly, did they find a crash just like we found? That's exactly the point, Dr. Fredericks, I said. What did they find? And if the Germans could get their hands on this material, what about the Soviets, he asked. But he was talking to himself now, talking in a way that made him sound as if he were really thinking out loud. Why not the Chinese or any of our European allies? Just how much of this stuff is out there, he finally asked me. We don't have any of those answers, I told him, at least not those of us in the Army. And for obvious reasons, nobody's walking around sharing this information back and forth among the services or with any other agencies. We have what we have, and that's as far as we're willing to go. And you don't want me talking about this or trying to sniff around for any information, he said. If we thought you were going to do that, I wouldn't even be here, I said. I have these reports here and descriptions of the device. I'll leave them with you. If you think you can work these into your development program, I'll have the material itself sent over. And then it's out of our hands completely. Farm it out to wherever you want it developed. Offer your defense contractor the right to patent it. Never tell them where you got it or what its origin might be. As far as we're concerned, whoever comes up with the night viewers you ultimately contract with to build can own the device, the whole product, and slap their name on it. All we want to do is get this thing developed. That's it. May I? Dr. Fredericks asked, reaching for the reports I'd spread out on the arm of the leather chair. I handed them across in a bundle, and he flipped through them as if he were my old college professor looking at a term paper, crumping, grunting, and nodding at every page. "That's more about how they handled the alien at Wright Field than about the eyepieces themselves," I said, "because in reality, they didn't know what made the thing tick, and they didn't want to tear it apart.